Welcome to another edition of the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. Tonight's presenter is Alan Proctor. He's going to talk about his brother Bruce Proctor, who was a war policy insider back in the Vietnam days and also left the American continent to go to Sweden to escape the Vietnam War. This is a new book that just has been released, and we're going to delve into Bruce Proctor's journey, and we're going to find out about the aftermath as well. This program was recorded on Sunday, December the 20th, at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. And we'll follow our usual format tonight. We will hear from Mr. Proctor for approximately 30-some minutes. We'll take a short break after that, and then we'll have about 20 minutes or so of questions from the audience for Mr. Proctor. So, without further ado, let's go right to the introduction.
Good morning. I'm Rita Norton, a member of the forum committee that organizes these platforms for the discussion of significant issues, especially those that involve ethical values in the contemporary world. Now is the time to turn off your phones for the entire program. And FYI, we are being recorded for in-church use and for probable broadcast on KKFI. Alan and Susan are both All Souls members since this past spring. Alan's The Sweden File, Memoir of an American Expatriate, is not at all his first publication. His poetry and prose have also appeared in New Letters, Chautauqua, Kansas City Voices, the I-70 Review, and Cross Timbers. The Sweden File has received a November Kirkus Review, and this past week The Star praised it as well. This sort of hybrid memoir has brought Alan to the forum. Many of us remember the sense of ongoing crisis that accompanied the so-called Vietnam War. The Sweden File makes that ongoing crisis real again for us. Alan.
Thank you all for being here this morning. Can you hear me? Okay. That's the book. I also want to thank All Souls for allowing me to make this presentation. A dual memoir, The Sweden File, Memoir of an American Expatriate, published last August by Westphalia Press, will be the context of my talk this morning. It's a dual memoir because both my brother and I are its authors. As with most authors who have recently published a book, I wanted to convince people to read it. Authors are shameless self-promoters, particularly if, like me, you are relatively unknown. But I was gently reminded by our All Souls sponsors that a 30-minute sales pitch might not be an appropriate way to talk at the forum. I appreciate Carolyn's offer to sell books in the lobby, but my talk this morning will be about why I think memoir is important, with a few examples from the book. The author, Barry Lopez, in his recent keynote address at a writers' conference in Portland, Oregon, talked about the importance of stories. We tell stories, he said, to revive ourselves in tyrannical times of human and environmental unraveling. We tell stories to capture hope and relate how we're moved to care for one another. We tell stories to keep each other from being afraid. In her sermon 2 weeks ago, Reverend Gibbons quoted a Robert Frost poem, "Choose Something Like a Star," that urged maintaining a personal linchpin against irrationality, mob rule, and fear. It was an inspiring sermon and illuminated the wisdom of a great poet. So, what about crafting this memoir shall I relate? Well, the true-to-life plot of the Sweden File is compelling. Through my brother Bruce Proctor's letters, his later reminiscences, and my own reflections on a time of social and political unrest, the memoir narrates a harrowing journey Bruce made in defying the United States government. In late 1967, at the height of the Vietnam War, my 24-year-old brother was a top secret war policy insider working in the Pentagon with the Defense Intelligence Agency, the DIA. He interpreted reconnaissance photos taken over Southeast Asia and what he saw with his 10 power loop, evidence of dead civilians, bomb craters on unauthorized flight paths, deeply disturbed him. Well, he muses with chilling Orwellian logic, if the damage doesn't get reported, then it must not exist. He concluded that he could no longer work for or support a government that was lying to its people. He told his superiors he was quitting the DIA. Their response? You can't quit, they said. You have top secret clearance. First, you must go through 6 months of debriefing. My brother, however, left that week, and it caused a furor. With top secret information, as a civilian on the street, he was a security risk. To avoid immediate conscription and possibly the long arms of the CIA and FBI, he joined the Air National Guard. National Guard units in 1967 were not being called upon to serve in foreign wars. But within a few months of Bruce's DIA departure, President Johnson ordered his unit, along with a few others, to Vietnam. So Bruce went AWOL, that's absent without leave, to Stockholm, Sweden. T.S. Eliot once wrote, "What we call the beginning is often the end, and to make an end is to make a beginning. The end is where we start." This is especially relevant to the Sweden File. Memoirs often start at the end to make a beginning. If you're middle-aged or older and can write a cogent sentence, you probably have what's needed to draft or craft a memoir. Recollections of pain and triumph, missives, photos, intriguing sticky notes. As someone said, if you've survived puberty, you have a story to tell. Bruce's life in the United States ended at age 25 when he boarded a jet plane bound for Stockholm, Sweden in July of 1968. A new life as an American expatriate had just begun. Here's a portion of Bruce's first letter to his parents, written on the day he left the United States. "Dear folks, there was reason, after all, for resignation to my fate. If I had really planned to go, I would have been very morbid. I have no desire to assist in the death of people. The war in Vietnam is irrational, immoral, and stupid. I'm on a bus to New York, where I'll fly to Stockholm, Sweden tonight. Rosemary," that was his wife, "will follow in 3 to 4 weeks after liquidating our modest property. She will also ship over household effects. I'll write as soon as I have an address in Stockholm. We know people there, so I'll be staying with friends. My first problem will be the language, but the government has free courses. There will be no problem with working. The Swedish law is very liberal with political refugees. They enjoy a sanctuary. Naturally, I do not plan to return unless there is eventually a legal way to do it. The Swedes run a rational social order, so there will be no problem with ordinary amenities of health and living. My strength and certainty that this is the right decision grows. I can feel that it is right. I do not seek an escape or transformation. I'm merely changing my territorial basis. Your son, Bruce. How wonderfully hopeful and naive that first letter is. Not to worry, folks, it's going to be a snap. No, it was certainly not a snap. Remember Barry Lopez's comment? We write stories to keep each other from being afraid. This is exactly the objective of Bruce's first letter to his parents. Our father, a government employee and retired naval captain, wrote back to Bruce 10 days later. Dear Bruce, this is the first time I have sat down to write anyone since returning from the hospital last Thursday. However, Mom didn't tell me until later. My immediate reaction was one of shock and fear. Shock at the realization of the courage it took to make a decision with such lifelong consequences, and fear of the long arm of the CIA and FBI taking possible defensive action against one in possession of classified information. The following recollection, written by Bruce 40 years after the day he left America, sharply contrasts with his first gleeful and carefully composed letter to his parents. It begins as he waits at Kennedy International Airport for his flight into exile. I had brought a book to read, he writes, but couldn't concentrate on it. I dressed casually so as not to attract attention and cursed my military haircut that might give me away. I had to remind myself not to succumb to the paranoia creeping up my spine, the animal instinct to crouch, looking closely at people wandering in the aisles, some of them looking for someone, wondering if that guy was going to approach me, ask for ID, and arrest me. The wait seemed interminable, but I eventually boarded and found my window seat on the left side of the big jet. Taking off over Long Island, heading east, I gazed down at the Atlantic beaches. Soon, however, clouds obscured the view, and I was not able to spot the South Fork of Long Island, East Hampton, or Three Mile Harbor. I cried. It came over me suddenly, no tears at first, just a shuddering in my chest and an effort to breathe normally, never again to play in the surf, sit in the dunes, share lunch on the beach, go skin diving and fishing in the harbor. Never again to take out the kayak, paddle in the early morning fog. All these memories washed through me in long sobs. And just to compound all that, thoughts of others followed in quick succession, the loss and unknown reaction of my mother, father, brothers, sister. On the long flight to Oslo and Stockholm, I gazed at the Greenland ice caps, an eerie dome of luminescence in the midnight sun slightly below the horizon, spreading a rose hue from below. I will submit we also tell stories, true or otherwise, to share feelings of loss in hopes we are not alone in our suffering. Throughout his four-year exile in Sweden and before he emigrated to Canada in 1972, there were many more letters from Bruce to family and friends that tried to assuage fear, offer counsel about separation anxiety, and put tyranny into a psychologically manageable perspective. A few letters, although not those to his parents, fail to comfort on all accounts, and seemed to me dipped in the ink of cynicism. The Vietnam War was a cultural phenomenon shared by most of us in this country. And I'd like a show of hands. How many of you in the audience were old enough to understand that we were at war, or who had family members or relatives who were deeply affected by it? Virtually everyone. Yeah. Some of you may have served in the military during the conflict. Some of you may have protested our involvement in Vietnam, as I did. Whether you served or protested, we should honor your choice. I was in the Kansas City Library recently talking to a history professor about the memoir. The professor asked, "Do you have the original papers securely stored?" "In a file upstairs," I said. "Lock them in a vault," he said. "They're historical documents." I was puzzled at first. Historical documents? And then I realized that if in 1973 I had not begun to collect my brother's letters during his life in Sweden, they might now all be moldering in a landfill somewhere. Another show of hands. How many of you keep old letters, scrapbooks, photos, diaries? Almost the same number. These are the grist for memoir. Here's another reason why memoir is important to me anyway. It can complete what is often incomplete in existing historical records. My great-grandfather, Wilbur Huntington Proctor, a drummer boy in America's Civil War, kept a diary throughout the war. As he recounts in one passage, the conflict raged until dusk. And the next day, I went fishing. Who knew the tempo of that awful war could be so fickle? The diary, incidentally, is now housed in the Beinecke Rare Book Library at Yale University. Have you ever wondered why you like to sketch, say, or write, or play the violin? Having a window through which to look upon our past can be revealing. Ask someone who does not know his or her biological parents if this knowledge is trivial. My best friend, Thomas, who became a talented artist and sculptor, agonized about why he was so different from his government service father, Dr. Walter White. Thomas didn't find out he was adopted until he was in his teens. He crafted a cap with a handprint on it and the words, "Thomas Glover White is not real. Not real." One of our distant relatives, Samuel Huntington, governor of Connecticut and signer of the Declaration of Independence, was president of Congress assembled from 1779 to 1781. Even before Google, I knew these facts because our father, Bob Proctor, was an avid genealogist. Perhaps this genetic thread reveals why Bruce was so interested in politics as a young man. When I was 14 and he was 19, he said to me, "Did I ever tell you I was going to be Secretary of State someday?" Bruce and I are directly descended from John Proctor, made famous in Arthur Miller's play, The Crucible, based on Miller's research of the Salem, Massachusetts witch trials in the 1690s. After being accused of bewitching his servant, Proctor accepted his guilt to save his life. He didn't believe in witches, and he knew his confession was a lie. He later recanted it for the sake of his dignity and perhaps his soul. Like his ancestor, Bruce faced two choices: conforming to a system he knew to be riddled with lies, or opposing the misled status quo and suffering the consequences. John Proctor's consequence was decisive and quick. He was hanged in 1692. the outcome of Bruce's decision to buck the U.S. government was less dramatic, but nonetheless devastating. He was unable to be a player in the halls of political power that he so passionately desired in his youth. Memoir, recounting the past to capture the very human craving for a lasting legacy, for not being forgotten. Could you go to the next slide, please? Here's Bruce at a kitchen sink in Stockholm. In Sweden, Bruce became a master of yoga, yet also had binges with drugs and alcohol. Many of his letters never fully recounted the stories behind his failure to learn the language and integrate into polite Swedish society. That's why, several years before his death, in 2011, I asked him to reminisce on the letters, to fill in the blanks about his life in what he first thought would be a utopian existence. He did this brilliantly. He worked his work as a taxi driver, common laborer in a light bulb factory and sawmill, his job as a camp counselor for disturbed children, one of whom held a knife at his throat, his near impoverishment. Here's Bruce in one of his many Stockholm slum residences. He moved almost 30 times while in Sweden, washing dishes in his tiny sink, where the hot water lasted only as long as Swedish kroners, coins of the realm, were fed into a slot on the wall. Although not revealed in the letters, in his reminiscences, he did mention meeting two American deserters who went AWOL from their naval aircraft carrier, the Intrepid, in 1967 when it docked for some R&R in a Japanese port. The men, later known as the infamous Intrepid Four, ever heard of them? These men never returned to the ship and were soon contacted by the Japanese Peace for Vietnam Committee. The sailors thought they would be taken to the countryside and live underground. Instead, they were rounded up onto a freighter on a darkened dock in the middle of the night. Bruce writes, "They told us the ship disembarked before sunrise into a murky, rainy winter night. This isn't so bad, the sailors said, as they surveyed the stateroom appointments. Tired from the sleepless night on the road, they fell asleep. They were shaken awake by four men dressed in black, carrying AK-47s. Come with us, the men said. Grabbing for their few belongings, they were told to leave them, were frisked, and herded out the door, headed down a dark passageway towards the bow. Where are we going? They asked. Vladivostok, was the only answer. The AK-47s pointed them into a small compartment near the front of the ship, empty, except for a lone light bulb far overhead. The door was closed and securely bolted with the click of a lock sealing their chamber. The seas were heavy with a northwest gale, and the compartment went up and down like a roller coaster all night long, all through the day. Then Bruce recounts, the two sailors told us while we listened in rapt attention that they lost track of time and began to feel fear for their fate, for their lives, and even for their sanity. Finally, the ship docked. The door was opened and the dark-suited AK-47s waved them out, upstairs, onto a rainy deck, down a gangplank, and onto a waiting limousine. Other guards were inside. Where are we going? They asked. Would you like some vodka? Was the reply. An airport was nearby and they again were ushered upstairs into a big jet. Finally in the air and ravenous after the grueling trip, they were offered food. They slept, and when they landed in Moscow, They were somewhat rested, but totally disoriented. They had crossed 6 time zones. The Moscow interviews were like interrogations. First, separately and lengthy, covering their life history, their motivations, their connections to groups, the details of knowledge about aircraft carrier operations. All they knew was how the cables got connected to the nose of the aircraft. How, after one plane was catapulted off, the cable was guided into the nose of another aircraft. Interviews were conducted by experts, or so they later surmised by their English fluency, focus, and thoroughness. Probing was especially noticeable when it came to technical details or tactical fleet operations. Later, they met as a group and began to practice for the press conference. As the days passed, they relaxed and were treated well. Nice rooms, good food, the odd bit of entertainment, but not allowed to wander alone in the outskirts of the city. The press conference made international headlines. From Moscow, 4 deserters tell the world of the injustice of the war in Vietnam and their resistance to it. The propaganda machine that had been wound up inevitably slowed down. When it did, they were each given money and put on a plane to Stockholm. Bruce continues, by the time I arrived in Stockholm in July of 1968, the honeymoon was over for these 4 seamen. Journalists from the United States no longer wanted to take them to dinner at fancy restaurants. They were trying to move on with their lives. Some had Swedish girlfriends or worked as casual laborers, sometimes on the docks or elsewhere. With memoir, research takes many variant forms. Gathering personal documents, interviewing others, visiting the attic. For me, collecting the letters from and to Bruce while he was in Sweden was the beginning. I had saved all his letters to me and was surprised that nearly everyone I contacted had also kept his letters. In 1975, I tried to publish just the letters, but was told by Dick Grossman, a publisher friend of mine, that they didn't complete the needed arc for a book. I set them aside, and it wasn't until I retired that I returned to them, put them into a Word document, and sent them to my brother, requesting, as Paul Harvey used to say, the rest of the story. The first piece he wrote and sent back to me was in third person. He created a guy he called Jacob. No, 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 I emailed back. I want your true story. Write in first person. He did so. And for over a year, with remarkable recall, he sent back story after story. When I put the two components together, early letters and later reminiscences, I knew I had a book. All it needed was some context that Bruce would not have thought to include, things like his John Proctor, Samuel Huntington, and Wilbur Huntington Proctor ancestry, and also my perspectives on what was happening in America during the time of his exile. For example, this is an account from my last year at Earlham College, a Quaker institution. In the fall of 1969, the beginning of my senior year, longtime political loser Richard Nixon won the presidential election by appealing to the silent majority. I thought of my parents, older, timid, ideologically progressive, but practically conservative, and looking for law and order amid the concussions of violence they saw nearly every day on their TV. My father was a captain in the Naval Reserves. He had never expressed an opinion to me about Vietnam. I had never asked, which was too bad. In December of 69, 6 months before I graduated from Earlham, the Selective Service instituted a national lottery system that drafted males between the vigorous ages of 19 and 25. I was almost 22 years old. The draft was the administration's answer to a war from which 200,000 men had fled, either overtly or covertly. Demand for fresh meat couldn't keep pace with the available volunteers. The lottery assigned random numbers to birth dates, and that first year they churned through 195 unlucky birthdays. Mine, March 8th, put me at number 213 in the lottery. I was safe, at least for the time being. Thank you, depending on the draft board, yes. I graduated with a BA in English in June of 1970. The class valedictorian, a brilliant young woman named Janet, whose poetry had already been published, rose to give her address to the assembly of parents and students restless on the folding chairs set up in perfect rows on the grass. The audience fanned themselves with the programs. Janet came to the lectern, leaned over the microphone, and waited for quiet. "I don't understand anything," she said, quoting the poet Bill Knott. "If you do, tell it to me real slow, in one syllable corpses." Then she sat down. Landrum Bowling, the college president in full black and royal blue robes, tactfully asked for a moment of silence. That was my world in 1970. I was fresh out of college, eager to be on my own and wondering if my education would land me a job. My brother's world, in his second year of exile and struggling with life in Sweden, glimmered through a darker lens. Bruce emigrated to Canada in 1972. He realized his life in Sweden was spiraling downward. Recalling his final months of increasingly aggressive taxi driving and wayward behavior on his days off, he wrote, "I was also drinking more. On my days off, I would meet up with Dave G, buy a bottle of scotch, and ride the bus or the subway to the end of the line. When on the bus in the middle of the day, we would ride on the London type upper level, sit in the front, and drink scotch. I had never been a heavy drinker, but was becoming one, and I didn't like it. I must get out of here," I thought. Putting memoir on paper and sharing it can be painful. It was painful for me to read my brother's descriptions of his suffering and disillusionment. It took over 40 years to publish this book. I'm sorry Bruce is not here to share in that accomplishment, but as T.S. Eliot reminds us, to make an end is to make a beginning. Could you put the next slide up? President Jimmy Carter, on his second day in office, granted many former servicemen and women dishonorably discharged from military service for resisting the Vietnam War, my brother among them. Granted them with an upgrade to a less than honorable discharge. Because of Carter's pardon, Bruce was able to enter the United States without fear of incarceration. He could not vote and was denied all benefits, of course, but he was able to see his family and revisit the happy Long Island haunts of his youth. He wrote this letter to President Carter from a hospital bed in April of 2011, about 3 months before his death, from an undiagnosed gastrointestinal disease. Bruce knew he was dying. Part of his letter reads, "Thank you for your pardon of Vietnam and military war resistors. I was one of them. I count myself among your fans. I am thanking you now before it is too late for either of us." Carter at the time was 87, Bruce was 67. The former president's handwritten reply is in the upper right corner of Bruce's letter. To Bruce, it says, "Thanks for this letter. I'm glad to hear from you. Best wishes, Jimmy Carter." Many people, Vietnam veterans among them, have thanked me for compiling, editing, and publishing this book. One woman emailed me that when she finished the memoir, she better understood why her brother-in-law, who fled to Canada to escape the war, a few years later, killed himself. Next slide, please. That's Bruce in the foreground and me in the background about a year before he died. Bruce, in a small way, did attain his dream. After Sweden, he spent the rest of his life in Winnipeg, Canada, and rose to be one of a half dozen or so undersecretaries of education for the province of Manitoba. What if I had not collected the letters? What if I had left them in a filing cabinet and not asked my brother to expound upon them decades later? What if I had not taken the time to revisit my own youthful past and record it? Perhaps a small piece of history would have been lost forever. Next slide. Because authors are shameless self-promoters, and because my brother is unfortunately no longer with us, I won't be coy in telling you that last Sunday's Kansas City Star named the Sweden File as one of their 101 literary stars of 2015. My brother's book is right in there with Toni Morrison and Salman Rushdie. Whether we begin our stories at the beginning or at the end, our work as memoirists, keeping each other from being afraid, capturing hope and loss, illuminating how we're moved to care for one another, it's all important work. Take the plunge. Begin your own memoir. If not for the world at large, at least for those who will follow you, eager to peer into the window of the past. Thanks. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
We've just heard a presentation from Alan Proctor about a new book called The Sweden File, Memoir of an American Expatriate, about his brother Bruce Proctor. You're listening to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. We owe you a few messages. Let's take those. We will return very shortly with the second portion of our program for tonight, the questions from the audience.
I have a question about memoirs in general. I have a daughter who moved to France a number of years ago and has been living there with her two children. But today, the correspondence and communication is mainly over the phone or maybe emails, and letters are fairly uncommon. It seems to me that letters were the memoirs of past and diaries and things. What's being done today, and how do people deal with electronic communications and very different ways of keeping in touch with each other?
Well, as one of my professors told me, you don't write to be understood. You write so you cannot be misunderstood. And unfortunately, emails are jotted off very quickly. So all I can say is that when you send an email, make it very clear. Write so you cannot be misunderstood, because those are documents as well, particularly if you print them. What else is being done? You know, memoir often is someone just sitting down with a tablet or in front of the computer and just trying to remember. As with any book, it takes a lot of rewrite. It takes a lot of research. If it's a memoir based in the past, there are probably documents that you can get, diaries and so forth. I hope I've answered your question, at least in part.
So it sounds like Bruce was pardoned at some point, and why did he stay in Canada? Did he consider moving back to the United States?
No. He moved to Canada, and he got a pretty good job with the Department of Education. He visited many times. He came back to see his parents and his friends, but he lived out his life in Winnipeg. He divorced his first wife, Rosemary, and married again, and they adopted a child. He has another daughter with his first wife. She's living now in Toronto. And his first wife, who was an American, is also living in Toronto.
I'm curious to know if, since your book has been published, there's been any feedback from DIA, anything that has come from the government that reflects on this whole process and era?
No, I've had no such feedback. At first, I was waiting for the other shoe to drop, but I think there are so many other issues going on right now, and it was so long ago, and Bruce is dead, so no, I don't think there's going to be any of that kind of investigation.
Do you have any insight as to why he chose Sweden? Because I knew several people who left the country in that time period, but all of them went to Canada.
Yes, indeed. Most folks did go to Canada. He went to Sweden because he had a bad dream right before he left, and he told his wife, Rosemary, and she said, "Let's go to Sweden," because she had spent her junior year abroad in Sweden. She had made a few friends, and she knew the language, at least enough to get along. So that's why he ended up in Sweden.
He just asked the question that I was going to ask, but I've got another one. It's my understanding that the U.S. government used to stake out funerals for guys who would sneak back from Canada to go to a funeral. Mm-hmm. And I don't know when that's finally stopped. Mm-hmm. You?
No, I don't. I don't. Bruce took a trans-Canada trip in 71, and that summer before he got landed immigrant status in 72. And I know that when he came close to the U.S. border, the paranoia creeped back into him. He talks about that. So, but I do not know when that was no longer an issue.
From his first letter, it's obvious that he had very high expectations of the support he would get in Sweden. And my impression is that support didn't materialize in the way that he expected. Could you be a little bit more specific about that?
Sure. His wife, Rosemary, did have a job with the Swedish Peace Committee. But Bruce, although he took courses to try and learn Swedish, as he writes in his letter, he got it confused with Spanish. He was given a work permit, but it was for a common laborer. And so his jobs were as a common laborer. This is a man who used to debrief the Undersecretary of State. So this was a real disappointment for him. He worked on the docks. He worked, as I said, in a sawmill and so forth. But because he didn't really get a handle on the language, he could really not do anything else besides drive a taxi and be a common laborer.
I've read your and Bruce's book. I highly recommend it. You had mentioned earlier about the late 60s was a time of choice, and your brother had that choice, and I would guess all those who raised their hands earlier knew somebody or maybe faced that choice like you and I did. I think it's a successful story. I heard about your plans before you wrote it, and I thought it would be really an interesting issue, and it has fulfilled that. I'll ask you a difficult question. I thought Bruce was a man of courage. The difficult question I have is, he worked for the Department of Defense, and he was moved by the photos that he took. If he was anti-war at that time, why did he join the Air National Guard?
That's a great question. Bruce was very smart. He knew that the National Guard units at that time were not being sent into foreign wars. So that's why he joined the Air National Guard, so he would not be sent to Sweden. Some people, one person, thought my brother was a bit of a coward. And when I think of Bruce, I think of some of the things he did to face his fears. He was claustrophobic, so he joined a cave crawling club that nearly drove him crazy, but he kind of got over his fear of claustrophobia. He was also, to a certain extent, an opportunist. He saw a way to perhaps continue in this country without having to leave. But when President Johnson nationalized the unit to go to Vietnam, that's when he made the decision to leave. Does that answer your question? Good.
Yes, as you can tell, I'm the most youthful person in this group. Since he's been moving around like nearly 30 times, correct? In Sweden, he moved like nearly 30 times.
Yes, many times.
Who was taking his photos, like the one where he's washing dishes?
That would have been his wife, Rosemary. Yep. We have several photos, and there are a few photos, such photos in the book. Bruce moved many, many times in Sweden. Mostly they were rather run down. They were cold. He used to collect firewood from construction sites. He'd go out to the construction site and with a hatchet break apart some of the wood that was used to mold concrete and haul it back to his apartment to burn in their tiny stove. It was tough.
There's something about your voice as you spoke to us for 35 minutes that makes me shy about asking specific questions because I sense your personal involvement. How did this affect Alan Proctor as a young 20-year-old?
Well, because of my lottery number, I didn't really have to face this. When I started getting letters from Bruce in 1972, or in 1968 rather, I thought he was an incredible writer. And he had a lot of very interesting things to say. I was a young writer myself. I had just started to publish some poetry and was very interested in that craft. I have been my whole life. I just thought his letters were brilliant. They could be philosophical, humorous, obtuse, playful, all in one paragraph. I thought his writing was brilliant. And that's really why I kept them and was very surprised when I contacted others, and they, all of them, everybody had kept his letters.
When Bruce went to Sweden, was he involved, or did he put himself out there to be anti-war person? Did he join the groups there in his idealism?
Yes, he did. He was involved within 2 or 3 months. He found the committees, he says it quite brilliantly in his book, but he found them self-centered, focused on the issues that really weren't important. They criticized the group, at least that he was with, they criticized the Swedish government, that the government wasn't helping them enough. He got very disillusioned with his groups, and so he split from them.
I can't help but think there might have been some paranoia associated with the possible backhanded and secret activities of our government trying to trail in, causing grief and whatever. Were there any specific cases of our government thwarting his efforts and impacting his life?
There's one section in the book where he talks about being contacted by the government service in Sweden, and they took him to a building and they said, you see that guy getting into the car? Get a good look at him. And he surmised that perhaps that person was perhaps in collusion with the CIA. But other than that, he doesn't talk about that in the book, luckily.
The story of the Intrepid Four and their being the Japanese having them sent to Russia is absolutely bizarre. And thinking of it in a, you know, the context of Vietnam, and can you say anything more about that?
Well, really only what he wrote. I did do a little research on the Intrepid Four. I've forgotten the man's name, I think it was Chuck. He said that life, he is now back in the United States. He said life has been very tough. He's estranged from his children. He divorced his wife. But other than that, there were four of them, and they were used by the Russian government. And also, he mentions that the Japanese Peace Committee was infiltrated by Russian agents, and that's probably why he was that group was absconded to Russia. Once they were in international waters, they were they were interned as Russian sailors, essentially.
Kind of in response to Linda's question, I think I first heard of the Intrepid Four after Snowden wound up very unexpectedly in Russia, and they were drawing whatever sources were drawing parallels between the two. This is almost perfect timing to wrap up.
You've been listening to Alan Proctor talking about the new book, Memoir of an American Expatriate, about his brother Bruce Proctor and his journey from top-secret Pentagon war policy insider to American deserter. The program was recorded on Sunday, December the 20th of 2015 at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. That's at 4501 Walnut Street here in Kansas City. This program is produced and edited for broadcast each week by Barry Lee. Thank you to Rita Norton and her staff at All Souls for their help each week in presenting this program. You can find this in podcast form on KKFI's website within a few days. We also have a great number of All Souls programs archived for your use on that website, which is at www.kkfi.org. Just go right to our podcast page and you'll get a little drop-down box that will allow you to select the program you'd like to either download or audio stream. The music you're hearing, as you always do this week, beginning and end of the show, is composed and performed by Kansas City musician Fred Potter. We will return next week with another All Souls Forum right here on KKFI. Until then, stay tuned and keep it locked right here on 90.1 FM.